Welcome back to the program. The Ascent of Manhattan is a world-class city, is the center of the modern world, and its later decline into crisis shows that urban renewal was at the heart of both cultural and physical transformations. We're going to talk about urban renewal in New York and some of its implications for the gentrification we see taking place today with my guest, Samuel Zip. He's an assistant professor of American Civilization and Urban Studies at Brown University. He's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and The Nation, and it is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his newest work, Manhattan Projects, The Rise and Fall of Urban Renewal in Cold War New York. Samuel Zip, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. First of all, define what urban renewal is and was. It's one of those phrases that has been tossed around so much over the years, and I think so many people define it in kind of different ways.
Right. Well, we have a urban renewal is very much a was at this point. It's we have a sort of colloquial use of it just to describe any time that folks want to go and try to revitalize cities. But technically, in the way that I use it, urban renewal was a policy that was launched by the 1949 U.S. Housing Act, which looked to bring the powers of the federal government to bear on revitalizing cities, empowering private businesses and private interests to spend money to try to bring cities back from slums and blight, decentralization, all the problems that bedeviled cities in the years before and after World War II. So it was a policy that gave private interests a way to intervene in the city in a way they hadn't been able to before, because it just didn't pay for them to build in very overpriced land that was both really expensive because it was so dense, but also very run down. So it helped them to spend money to use slum clearance to clear away old 19th century houses and tenements and factories and warehouses and things like that, and build new projects. And it often used, almost always used, the sort of technologies of modernist architecture and urban planning. So the familiar, for those who think about American cities, architecture from this period, the kind of modernist architecture of very plain, unadorned surfaces, slab block towers, the so-called tower in the park with the open expanse around it, all this kind of architecture and planning that's very much now out of favor professionally, but then was the state of the art for rebuilding cities.
And talk about how it worked and why it was so controversial.
Well, urban renewal was a complicated phenomenon because it was both a national policy, as I said, through the 1949 U.S. Housing Act, but also it was locally administered and locally controlled. So you had all around the country, you had very different ways that it played out and very different ways that it would work. So the federal government provided a ton of federal subsidy and tax abatements for local agencies that were created by cities to go in and find places that they could use eminent domain to take land from lots of different owners in a place, put it together, and then send it off for put it up for bid for private interests who wanted to come in and build something. Now, in New York, it was a little different. New York was a complicated situation because there you had the famous figure that many people know about, Robert Curtis, who controlled the urban renewal situation in New York City, and he, rather than put it up for bid, put these eminent the land that had been gathered by an eminent domain up for bid, he would go ahead and before he had cleared the land, he would find a sponsor, a group of private interests who would want to build there. So, for instance, the best example in my book of this would be the Lincoln Square urban renewal area, which is most known to most people who visit New York as the home of Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, and that was a sort of the biggest urban renewal project in New York during this period. And Moses basically had the idea that he wanted to clear these blocks. It was about 48 acres, I think, of old tenements and warehouses and stores and just a working class neighborhood, and bring in some new kind of uses, because this was a fairly rundown area of the Upper West Side, although as it would turn out, it had a very thriving community there, and that was a lot of the controversy. So he got together some folks from Fordham University, which had a campus up in the Bronx. He got together a number of philanthropists and folks led by John D. Rockefeller III, who got together to create Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. And Moses partnered with them to clear away the slums, and they built up Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. Now, it turned out to be controversial because there were lots of people already living there, and they fought for their homes and their businesses, and they got together and created their own organizations that fought for the what they thought of as the culture of their own place, of their own neighborhood. So they said, you know, people are asking us to move and make way for this home for culture and the arts. Well, what about our homes? What about the interconnected lives we've created in this place? That's culture too. That should be seen and valued by the, you know, the city fathers, by the mayor, by Robert Moses, even by Rockefeller. They appealed to all these folks, and they launched all kinds of grassroots political organizations to try to turn it back. They failed, but their ideas went on. This was in the mid-50s. Their ideas went on later on to inspire many of the folks who would end up overturning the ideas of urban renewal in the 60s.
And, of course, you talk about the United Nations also being one of those projects.
Yeah, the United Nations is from a slightly earlier period, right? It comes right at the end of the war and is built in the late 40s and into the early 50s. And I think of the United Nations as a kind of symbolic, playing a symbolic role in the story of urban renewal. It's technically not an urban renewal project. It was funded through the 1949 Housing Act. But what it did was, is it really gave the idea of urban renewal this sort of large symbolic vision, right? It said, look, this is how you might rebuild cities. The space of the United Nations headquarters in Manhattan is often thought of as just the Secretariat Building, which is, of course, a big glass skyscraper, and architecturally it's gone on to have a lot of influence over, or went on to have a lot of influence over modernism, especially in New York and other cities where big glass towers like that were built. But it also, at the same time, was a model for urban planning. It had a big, wide, green space around it, park and open land. It had a kind of, was thought of as a vision for how cities might be rebuilt. And in this era, a lot of people talked about the way that the UN's vision for world peace could be paired with its vision for clearing away the city, clearing away the older neighborhoods of the city, the slums of the city, and for building a kind of city that was going to be equal to the vision of world peace that the United Nations has. And that was important for Manhattan as it sought to see itself as the kind of cultural and political capital of the world in the years after World War II. So in many ways, the United Nations was the idealistic core at the heart of what would happen in Manhattan over those years.
One of the other things that grew out of this was a huge amount of public housing. Talk about that.
Public housing was an important part of this whole era. Now, public housing and urban renewal have an interesting relationship because they are very linked, but they're very separate at the same time in a kind of, it's kind of ironic relationship they have. Many of the energies that went into creating the policies of urban renewal came out of the long-term activism and reform energies that created the public housing movement that went way back into the beginnings of the 20th century, particularly in New York, where public housing got its earliest start. But by the late 40s, when the policies for urban renewal were coming about, they were more driven by downtown business interests and real estate interests because they wanted to try, as I said before, to get private interest involved in rebuilding the city. Because during the deal era in the 1930s, there had been a housing act, the 1937 Wagner Act, that put some money into public housing. But there had never been a way to get private interest because it really just didn't pay until the federal government stepped in. So in 1949, the Housing Act that came about then provided for both urban renewal, the privately backed projects, and for more public housing. But public housing was extremely controversial. So as we know today from many of the debates over healthcare and other things, it was seen as a kind of socialistic enterprise. And in those years when the Cold War was just coming out, it was even more controversial because it was seen as something that represented the economy, an economic intervention in the free market economy like the Soviet Union was creating, or even the social democratic states of Europe. And so it was very controversial. So it survived to some extent, but it survived in many ways as a very much a junior partner to urban renewal. And over the years, it was more and more pared down on the federal level, how much money would be allowed for it. And, of course, as we know, it became really very stigmatized in cities around the country to the extent now where most cities are tearing down their public housing. Now, New York and Manhattan in particular is an exception to this. They don't tear down public housing in New York. It's actually been something of a success. The New York City Housing Authority, which built and runs New York's public housing, has been relatively successful compared to some of the other housing authorities, particularly in cities like Chicago, where they were very controversial and really very corrupt. And it's been somewhat successful, particularly in its ability to take, you know, very expensive urban land, take it out of the real estate market, and keep it affordable for lower middle class and working class people in the city. So in some sense, its legacy is quite unique in New York.
But of course, part of it was also these monolithic housing projects,
right,
that came into such disrepute.
That's right. It was, and that's the other side of it, right? Which is the impact that this vision of modern architecture and urban planning had on cities. So on the one hand, while we might want to be to defend urban public housing for its reserving this kind of housing stock for middle income or low income, also had this kind of overweening impact on the city, and that was immediately felt by many people. It was particularly true in the neighborhood of East Harlem, and that's one of the places that I look at, where there was lots and lots of public housing coming in. It was one of the most heavily rebuilt neighborhoods in the city. And there was a coalition of social workers who had been working under the auspices of the Union Settlement House there in the city for a long time. Union Settlement House was founded in the late 19th century. And they had been calling for new housing to offset the problems of all the kind of social environmental problems that they saw in these old working class districts. And so they were happy when all this new housing came in. They saw themselves as partners with the New York City Housing Authority and with this new money that was coming in the late 40s and early 50s. But very soon, as so much public housing was put down in that neighborhood, they started to see new problems. And the people were being uprooted and displaced and shifted across the landscape, and the people who were moving into these new large towers and into these new spaces felt alienated. They felt like they had been displaced from familiar neighborhood landmarks, and they began to see what the social workers called a new way of life. And that's really where we get a lot of these ideas about these places being alienating and full of a sort of dystopian landscape. And so they worked to try to redesign some of these places, and they called on the services of the writer and urbanist Jane Jacobs, who's best known for her book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. But before she wrote that, she worked with these folks in the late 50s in East Harlem to try to rethink public housing, and they went through a number of different ways of trying to rethink the design of public housing, to try to knit it back into the old streetscape. And they were somewhat successful in some of that. And their influence also went on to help people to rethink how we might plan cities, not from the perspective of these towers and these plazas, but from streets and stoops, from the actual landscape of the city. And so that's right. Another way that urban rule was sort of undone in these years.
But it's also part of the reason why public housing was more successful in New York than Chicago, for example, where it was these huge monolithic projects, these huge mm-hmm. towers that were very dehumanizing.
Right. Yeah, Chicago has its own very complicated history of all that, one which I'm not entirely an expert on. But it is true that in Chicago, the housing far more segregated from the rest of the city. In New York, you had a much more, particularly in Manhattan, this is less true in some of the boroughs out in Brooklyn or the Bronx, where they could be a little bit more segregated. But in New York, they would often be far more integrated within the streetscape, integrated sometimes even in neighborhoods that were not necessarily just working-class neighborhoods, although they're, you know, it's different from place to place. But it's certainly true that there are a lot of reasons why it succeeded more in New York. One of them is that integration. One of them is the fact that people in New York are far more used to living in high-rise buildings, in big apartment buildings, and the New York City Housing Authority was in many ways better run than some mm-hmm. of its other ones. But yeah, but public housing is in many ways the sort of great dilemma of this era. How do we find ways to both stop the tide of slums, but also to rehouse all the people who are going to be uprooted when we go in and clear these places away? So this is the great thing upon which the great political dilemma on which urban renewal ended up faltering and falling apart, along with this feeling that people had when they moved to these new spaces, that these weren't the kinds of places they wanted to live, that these were places more fit for, in many ways, say, the Soviet Union or perhaps Europe, right, which is where I see this being a kind of Cold War question, too. People struggling over what it meant to live in the United States in cities in a period where we were in this political struggle with the Soviet Union, where they were aggressively building places like this and tapping it as a way to solve the problems of the industrial era.
The other thing that was going on was a kind of deindustrialization of American cities, New York being the penultimate example.
Yes, exactly. It's true. I think that one of the things that urban renewal was supposed to try to do was to try to offset the decentralization that was happening, both in terms of residences, suburbanization that we're all familiar with, and in terms of the fact that industry was leaving the cities. New York had been a very, up through World War II and just after, a very powerful industrial city, not in the way of a Detroit or a Pittsburgh or even a Chicago, where big major steel industry or the car industry, one of those dame, but it was a place where there were lots of little factories producing lots of little things, you know, and in these little niche industries, the garment industry, the printing industries, things like that. And a lot of that was started to be hollowed out in the years after World War II. And urban renewal in many ways was an attempt to try to keep some capital and money and people downtown, to keep them coming back to the cities. Now, the truth was that it was many an attempt to keep a middle class downtown. There were half-hearted attempts here and there to do industrial urban renewal, but it was never focused on the way that that keeping middle-class people, shoppers, audiences, in the case of Lincoln Center, back downtown were. And so in many ways, urban renewal ended up exacerbating the problems that it attempted to solve by further segregating the city, further causing problems with decentralization. And that's sort of one of the tragic ironies of urban renewal.
In many ways, when we look at urban renewal, it's kind of the forerunner of some of what we debate today with respect to gentrification.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that when we've had a little bit of time to look at this and a little bit of time to get some distance on this, I think that we can see that urban renewal, for better and for worse, was kind of one of the forerunners of gentrification. It sort of set the stage for gentrification, in that it, especially in Manhattan, it took these places that were seen as really, really working class districts, places that were residences and places where people worked and lived, working class people, and it turned them into places that were more white collar, and it provided a kind of beachhead for middle class and white collar folks in Manhattan. And in some ways, gentrification just kind of spread through more market processes rather than government supported processes over the years since the age of urban renewal. And so now that the island of Manhattan and many parts of Brooklyn are entirely white collar and entirely middle class or upper class, of course. And there were, of course, many parts of Manhattan that were before that. But New York, Manhattan, even in a way that we don't understand today, immediately after World War II, was very much a working class space. And then that's, of course, changed entirely now. And I think for better and for worse, urban renewal had a role in this.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Robert Moses before. Talk about his role in all of this, because he was really, in this period, the Cold War in New York, he was really one of the prime players.
He was. And, many accounts of urban renewal have placed him at the center, and I don't intend to dislodge that centrality that he had. But I do want to try to see the way that, following the lead of some other historians who've looked at this in the last few years, the way that Robert Moses needed a lot of allies and a lot of partners to get things done in particular places around the city. So like I talked about at Lincoln Center, he needed people who had particular roles to play, particular places where they could intervene in local politics or could draw on, in the case particularly of Lincoln Center, on large national and even international constituencies in the way that, say, the Rockefellers and other folks who were involved in Lincoln Center could. And he needed to have these partners in this, what I think of as a kind of a larger liberal political culture in New York, to go in and make actual local interventions in particular places. So Moses had a great vision for the city, an incredibly extensive vision, and a lot of that had to do with things that I don't deal with too specifically, his highway projects,
right,
his park projects, his large vision of creating a kind of regional transportation and movement system for goods and people around the city through highways and expressways and all these sort of things. But, you know, he was also very involved with running these urban renewal projects, with figuring out where he wanted to clear and where he could get somebody to come in and help him and to carry out projects. So he needed partners to fulfill this large vision that he had.
Talk a little bit about Jane Jacobs, because one of the ironies, it seems to me, is that while she played a role in dealing with some of the problems of urban renewal at the time, that in many ways it was her ideas about a kind of new urbanism that really helped foster a lot of the gentrification that came later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jacobs is a very interesting figure, and she's getting a lot of attention these days. You know, she's often been... people have called her sort of Saint Jane, right? She's sort of been canonized as the great urbanist of the last 30 to 40 years. And there's good reason for that. She is an incredible figure. She wrote brilliantly about post-war cities. Probably, Death and Life of Great American Cities is probably the first book anyone wanting to understand cities should read. It's fascinating and it's amazing. And it came out of this struggle over urban renewal. It came out of her looking at what was going on in New York during this period. Many of the different projects, we often remember, those who are familiar with the book will remember her account of Greenwich Village and her street in Greenwich Village, and that's what stays with people, the ballet of the Greenwich Village street and all that. But a lot of the book also dealt with contemporary projects, things that were happening not just in Greenwich Village but around the city. We dealt with Stuyvesant Town, one of the places that I talk about, dealt with Lincoln Center, dealt with, as I mentioned, East Harlem. She was deeply involved with what was going on in East Harlem. And it was really from these projects, from the way they were building across the 1950s and the way things were happening, that she learned to start to think about the city in a different way. It was from various different people who were starting to protest urban renewal in different ways that she started to think about how you might rebuild or rethink cities from a different perspective. Now, a lot of it is goes down to her particular talents, her particular way of thinking, and she catalyzed all this in Death and Life of Great American Cities, and in some of the struggles she undertook also in Greenwich Village, just as Death and Life was coming out against the Lower Manhattan Expressway, against an urban renewal project, a sort of a post-Robert Moses urban renewal project in Greenwich Village that he was actually not involved with because he had already been sort of deposed from his urban renewal duties by the early 1960s after so much controversy. So she comes in as this tide is building against urban renewal and catalyzes it, really gives it a new language to think with, and so builds off the energies that are already there and then really pushes it forward to the next level, we might say, where it becomes a real movement against urban renewal that crests in the 1960s and really undermines urban renewal as a vision for making cities in the late 60s and early 70s. And, of course, the irony you mentioned is that her vision for remaking cities, this kind of bottom-up molecular vision of cities where people are going about their own business or going about their own lives and making their own lives rather than having it made from a top-down authority, whether it be private or public, really does end up being the way that cities actually get rejuvenated in the late 70s, 80s, and up into our own time. So she has, while she would not have condoned this, I do think that the processes that she was interested in furthering had a role in gentrification. Now, she also had ideas about how you would prevent those forces from becoming, from overwhelming neighborhoods and making neighborhoods into what she would have called monocultures, right? Just really overly developed places where there's not the kind of diversity and mixed use that she liked, which is what often happens with gentrification. But those aren't those ideas which were sort of involved and dealt with some public intervention in trying to keep neighborhoods mixed use and mixed income. Those aren't many of the ideas that often survive from the readings of Jacobs. It's more her ballet of Greenwich Village and all that kind of stuff. So she did have an interesting role in all that. And one of the interesting things about Jane Jacobs is the way she's embraced by both the left and the right. Mm-hmm. She's sort of seen as a hero on the left, of course, for her championing of social movements, of neighborhood resistance to the powers that be, so to speak, trying to crush neighborhoods. And for the right, she's seen as a hero for her championing of commerce, of of the everyday life of business and back and forth of commerce in neighborhoods. And so she's seen as kind of a hero of laissez-faire. So she's an interesting figure because she straddles that divide.
And it's interesting, one of the projects you talk about, Stuyvesant Town, which it was sort of an early version of this kind of monoculture within a city.
That's correct, yeah. Stuyvesant Town was a housing development that was built by the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. And it was started, it was actually conceived of during World War II in a partnership between MetLife and Robert Moses. And it was really the first attempt in New York, and in many ways the first attempt around the country, to try to get private capital involved in redevelopment and slum clearance in a major way. There have been small attempts before, but this was the major one. So in a way, it's what historians have called it sort of a blueprint for urban renewal, because it was carried out and built before the 49 Housing Act, but it was used with state and city subsidies instead. But it was a kind of, in its planning and in its political economic dimensions, it was really a blueprint for how that would be done later. And it was very much a monoculture, a huge block of modern housing development, super block planning with the towers in the park, the whole thing, that was built on on Manhattan's Lower East Side. It cleared about 18 blocks square of a neighborhood that was called the Gas House District between First Avenue, 14th Street, and the river. And it was an interesting project in that it was extremely controversial. It was both eagerly awaited by many people just after the war because it looked to provide housing during a terrible housing shortage. But it was also segregated, and it cleared this whole neighborhood. And so there was a lot of controversy surrounding it. It was eventually desegregated, and people who moved in there tried to figure out how to live in this new kind of place. And that's one of the things that I concentrate on, is how people figured out what it meant to live in a place that was both middle class but also had this mass scale. And so they went through all kinds of negotiations, both through themselves and figuring out what it meant to live in these new tall buildings with very repeatable sort of mass produced spaces. It was often called a barracks and things like that. And they tried to make a middle class life there. In many ways, Stuyvesant Town has been very successful. I think that despite all the controversy that attended its creation, it's become a place that now is seen as a kind of bastion of old New York values, middle class values, and is now, its future is very much in doubt right now as it's been sold and resold, and there's been all sorts of controversy around Stuyvesant Town, especially. But it's sort of interesting to see the controversy around it now in light of the controversy that attended its creation, when it was very much seen as the blueprint for this new policy of urban renewal.
It also became kind of a blueprint for what would move out to the suburbs in terms of these new towns and new cities that would spring up later in the 60s, in some ways patterned after kind of a suburban vision of what Stuyvesant Town was in the city.
Yeah, I think that might be true. That's an interesting way to think about it. I mean, I tend to think about Stuyvesant Town as a kind of competitor to the suburbs, to the mass-produced suburbs that we're so familiar with around New York, like, say, Levittown, but they're really all over the country, coming in these years in the late 40s and particularly throughout the 50s. And Stuyvesant Town, in many ways, was an attempt to do in the city what they were doing out in the suburbs. I mean, even MetLife called it, in their own promotional language, a suburb in the city. But it's true that later on in the 60s, in the New Town movement, places like Columbia, Maryland, or Reston, Virginia, that single developers would go and build, were often very very programmed in the way that Stuyvesant Town was, probably even more so than Stuyvesant Town. In many ways, Stuyvesant Town was kind of put up, and then people had to figure their own way. MetLife had a lot of rules and regulations and things, but some of the new towns seem to me even more sort of an attempt to try to return city values to suburban life. And in many ways, Stuyvesant Town was the opposite. It was trying to bring a little bit of the suburb into the city so the middle class would embrace it rather than go to the suburbs.
Samuel Zip, his book is Manhattan Projects, The Rise and Fall of Urban Renewal in Cold War New York, just out from Oxford University Press. Sam, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.